Hello, I'm Kevin Youngblood. This is number 0483, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0483. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actor-director Bill Duke, who talks about his career both in front of and behind the camera, and shares a little bit of his autobiography, Bill Duke, My 40-Year Career on Screen and Behind the Camera.
I had no idea what I was facing. If you have an idea, you want to write your autobiography, but condensing your life into 100 and some pages or a little more, you have to be selective. You have to not just reflect about your life, but what is significant to you, and going through that process. Because as you know, writing is an isolated incident. You sit down by yourself and you just do it. It was challenging, but I'm so glad I did. I really am.
Singer actress Carolyn Fay and her new album, Sugat Ko.
Sugat Ko in Tagalog, Philippine national language, means my wound. It's haunting, it's painful, it's eerie, it's and then the gospel of hope. I need to get out of this.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and on Book Banter, we look at fear. Bob Woodward's book about the Trump White House, that's called Fear, to be exact. So have no fear. We'll be here to review this book coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0483 was Kevin Youngblood, a production automation director at CTV in Edmonton, Alberta. And a very nice guy, too. Thank you very much, Kevin, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? On November 11th, St. John's County Sheriff's deputies in Florida responded to reports of a car crashed into a home in St. Augustine Shores. Officers discovered the car's driver, 58-year-old Darren Dwayne Touchton, had previously had a relationship with the homeowner, and at the time of the incident, another person was with her at the home. Touchton did not approve, the deputies stated, and when he saw the other man in the front yard, he floored his Nissan Maxima in an attempt to kill the interloper, but the target jumped out of the way and Touchton hit the house. So, basically, Touchton saw the guy, hit the roof, then hit the gas, then hit the house. Okay. Police also determined Touchton had previously threatened to kill the man with his car. He was charged with attempted homicide, 3 counts of aggravated assault, and driving on a suspended license. I know, I say this a lot. But I can't for the life of me understand why in almost every one of these stories that involves a car, the perpetrator almost always seems to have a suspended license. Is there no potential criminal out there who can legally drive before they commit a crime? Just asking. And in a similar vein, just before 2 a.m., an officer from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police pulled into a drive-thru in Lower Sackville, Nova Scotia to get dinner. The driver in the car in front of him made a nice gesture. He tried to pay for the officer's meal. When the officer got out to explain to the driver that they appreciated the offer but couldn't accept, the officer noticed that the man was drunk and his car was unregistered and his license had been suspended. The unnamed 42-year-old driver was arrested. Talk about generous to a fault, huh? And again, I remind you, suspended license. This is truly becoming an epidemic. An armed robbery of a McDonald's in Macon, Georgia, by a man wearing a wig was interrupted when the robber was shot. The employees had fled, so it became clear that the robber had apparently accidentally shot himself. The robber also fled, and a few minutes later, a man was heard yelling for help nearby. When police arrived there, they found 26-year-old Dante Sherrod Grayer with a bullet wound in his left thigh. He had stripped down to his boxer shorts and was lying amid his clothing, matching the description of the robber's attire. He was also steps from a wig and scattered money traced to the robbery. Grayer will be taken to jail once he is released from the hospital. There are so many Golden Arches-themed nicknames to apply to Dante. McSharpshooter comes to mind. How about McIdiot? McThighmaster, Ham Bungler, Charred Patties, McBullet Butt. Oh, I could go on, but I'll stop there. Let's just move on to another Golden Arches instead, shall we? In Bluffton, South Carolina, a McDonald's employee was charged with third-degree assault and battery Friday after she slapped her manager while trying to force-feed her a strip of purloined bacon. The assault occurred just after 1:30 p.m., A manager at the restaurant told one of the cooks to stop eating bacon in the kitchen while she's working. The employee continued to eat the bacon, so the manager told her boss. That angered the employee, who backed the manager into a corner and tried to shove hot, crispy bacon into her face in an effort to make her eat it, the report said. Bacon. When the manager tried to push her away, the employee hit her on the left side of the face while hanging on to the bacon. The employee then threw a cup of an unknown substance at the manager. At this point, another employee stepped between the women and the manager called 911. A judge issued an arrest warrant for the employee. Wow. Assault with bacon. That's just not kosher. What a piggish crime, huh? At least the employee didn't throw the bacon. That would be swine flu. Yeah, I know. Anyway, one more story here we have to share with you before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A few weeks after she was robbed at gunpoint while delivering pizza, a Reading, Pennsylvania woman told the detective she knew who the robber was. He'd friended her on Facebook. According to the woman, 26-year-old Jarell Guzman sent the request with a message saying he wanted to apologize, and she immediately recognized him from his profile photo. Guzman was arrested on charges of robbery, theft, and assault. Well, he also needs to work on his privacy settings. Just saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor-director Bill Duke has had a long and illustrious career in front of and behind the camera. He's appeared in many hit movies from Car Wash to American Gigolo, Commando, Predator, and X-Men: The Last Stand, just to name a few. He's directed a myriad of popular TV shows and even helmed hit films such as Sister Act 2. Bill has written his autobiography entitled Bill Duke, My 40-Year Career on Screen and Behind the Camera. And Bill joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Bill.
Hi, my friend. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. In putting together your autobiography, and it is an amazingly illustrious career, sometimes we don't see the forest for the trees while we're doing stuff, but you had a chance to sit down and reflect on just the breadth of your career. Did it impress you as you were writing it?
I had no idea what I was facing. When you have an idea, you want to write your autobiography, but condensing your life into 100 and some pages or a little more, you have to be selective. You have to, not just reflect about your life, but what is significant to you, and going through that process. Because as you know, writing is an isolated incident. You sit down by yourself and you just do it. And so it's been challenging, but I'm so glad I did it. I really am.
Now, you have done so much. When you first started your career, what was your game plan? Where did you see your career going when you started out as an actor?
Well, I hoped I would be Sidney Poitier, you know. He was the basic example of, I think, all young black actors, a man with dignity, talent, tenacity. He went through so much, but he never let anything stop him. And so I really wanted to be Sidney Poitier. You know, I wanted to be that. I mean, he stood up for himself, and he stood up for the dignity of our race, and it was such a powerful influence on me. And so that was my major influence was him.
Was it your intention early in your career to also direct, or was that something that came to you organically through time?
Well, you know, I directed theater, but I was intimidated by the cameras and the equipment and the crew and everything. And so, you know, it came to me gradually. But I'll tell you a story. This is true, and I'll try to be as brief as possible, how I got my first directing job. And I had gone to the American Film Institute and graduated and with a film that got some attention called The Hero, and I went out to every studio trying to get my first job as a director on a TV show or film. I was rejected. I got depressed. I do transcendental meditation. I went on retreat. I was there a week, and my agent calls me and says that, hey, David Jacobs at Knott's Landing wants to see you. Oh, my God. I said, and I got back to L.A. as soon as possible. Was in David Jacobs' office that Monday. We talked for a few minutes, and I said, oh, this is not going to happen. So I forgot about it. And then my agent called me a week later and said, hey, David Jacobs wants you to direct Knott's Landing. I called everybody I knew, man. I just went crazy. So I was in pre-production for a week, and Joe Wallenstein, the producer, came and said, Bill, you know, you did a great job in pre-production, but we know you were going to be great, you know, from your reel. I said, what reel? He said, well, the reel that you turned. I said, no, I just got an AFI. He said, wait a minute, Bill, hold on. He goes into David Jacobs' office. David Jacobs had mixed my box up with another director. And that's how I got my first job.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, and you know, I mentioned a lot of your credits in front of the camera and one behind the camera being Sister Act 2. But in television, you've done things like Dallas, Falcon Crest, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice. The list goes on and on and on. Do you find that as an actor, it makes you a better director?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, working with directors who understand actors and what actors go through, which is, my God, it shouldn't be called acting. It should be called being. You have to become the person that the writer wrote. And it means surrender. And surrender means falling into darkness, like falling into darkness backwards. And if you have a director that understands that, then he builds trust, or she builds trust around you. And you know that you're safe. You know that you can be vulnerable, all those things. But if you're just thinking about the shots, the camera, the lighting, it's a whole different reality. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Do you feel you came along as a director in what can be considered maybe the golden age for young black directors, especially in television? I think of people like Paris Barkley and Eric Lanouville and yourself. They seem to be a lot of good young directors who were doing a lot of work in that time period. Would you say that's an accurate assessment?
Yes. Once we were allowed in, you know, we had to prove ourselves, and we did. And we were very fortunate to have people that believed in us and gave us other jobs based upon that. So it was a very fortunate time. I'm not saying it was easy, but I'm just saying that during that time, it was pioneering days for young black directors, and I'm just grateful that I was one of the people who was there at the time.
Now, you know, not everything is all sunshine and roses. In your book, you talk about some of the things that were some of the hardships for you as well. Was it difficult?
Yeah.
Was it difficult or cathartic to write about those experiences?
I think it was both difficult and cathartic, you know. Difficult because, you know, you don't want to be a complainer or anything or blamer. But the fact that you could get it out of your guts, you know, is cathartic. And you want to be able to just tell the truth about what really happened. And so to write the book was cathartic in many, many ways for me to express my true feelings about my past.
Is there something in your career, because again, you've done so much, is there something you haven't done that you still want to accomplish?
Yes, you know, there are certain film ideas that I have, you know, that I want to, and I believe, I'm a lover of documentaries. I have several documentaries I want to get funded. You know, directing to me is a wonderful, wonderful craft, and you get to speak your voice. And I have a number of projects that I really want to do. I have one, you know, called, Black Diamonds, which is a documentary on the evolution of minorities and women in sports. And I just think it's important that we remember those people who were here before us and sacrificed so much that we could be here. And so they're just a certain homage I want to use film for, put it that way.
Do you see yourself more as a director than an actor?
Yes. You know, in directing, you have a voice. You know, you're able to have a voice and to talk about things you want to talk about. As an actor, yes, you involve yourself in films that you want to be a part of, but it's the voice of a writer and the director who's directing it. It's a different reality. So I just love directing because it's like, gives you a voice.
I asked you earlier if you thought it was easier to be a director because you had been an actor. Let me flip that question to the other side. How has being a director affected your work when you act?
Well, you know, when you experience what a director has to go through, I mean, you are judged on not on how much every minute costs, but every second. So, you know, as an actor, if you're aware of what the director is facing, you try to help him as or her as much as possible in terms of being prepared. Not making them wait for anything, adjusting to what their needs are because they're on a schedule. And directing is really two disciplines. One is the creative side, but the second side of it is management, and it's management of three things: time, people, and money. And if you cannot manage, then you don't work.
One of the things you've also done is you've, in addition to being very busy, you've also managed to find time to give back. You established the Duke Media Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Duke Media Foundation, you can go online on dukemediafoundation.org, and we support young people and families who are interested in our industry, and we teach two things: media literacy, which is understanding the business of our industry and how we've shifted from film and television to media. And by media, we mean augmented reality, you know, virtual reality, cell phone apps, Hulu, Crackle, Netflix, Amazon. It goes on and on and on. And so the jobs that in front of the camera, but also programming and all the things behind those elements. We also teach financial literacy. We are taught how to spend money, but not how to use it. We teach, what is the FDIC? What's the Federal Reserve? What is the stock market? You know, what is Wall Street? What is saving? What is debt? What is interest? What is compound interest? And so that people have an understanding of not only how to spend money, but how to use it. Because this business is up and down. You're working for 2 years, and then some people don't work for another year or two. And so what do you do to, you know, it's we try to give them nuggets of information that will help them survive.
So now that you have this autobiography out, Bill Duke, My 40-Year Career on Screen and Behind the Camera, which I'm sure will be a hit, put on your director's hat now. Should this be made into a movie, who gets to play Bill Duke, in your estimation?
Well, if Arnold were here, Arnold Schwarzenegger would say he should play Bill Duke. So I don't think that would be good. Well, I never, to be honest with you, I never thought of it as a film. I never thought of it as a movie. And now that you present that question, it's a good question. I have to give it some thought. You know, there are a lot of young, great actors out there these days. I really appreciate, you know, and from the older guys, even, you know, Denzel and Sam and people like that. But I guess they, in telling my story, I never thought about it in terms of a film, but it's given me an idea, at least, put it that way.
There you go. Something else to put in your bucket list there. Bill, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you. Continued success with the book. Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
And also, one last thing I would say, that please check me out in the show I'm in Atlanta doing right now called Black Lightning. It's a superhero, black hero. I'm not that hero, but I'm in the show for 8 episodes. So it's a great show. Check it out. It's on Tuesday nights on CW. Please check it out.
Black Lightning on the CW Tuesday nights. Thanks very much, Bill.
All the best. Thank you.
Actor, director Bill Duke. His book is entitled Bill Duke, My 40-Year Career on Screen and Behind the Camera. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0483, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You can also find links to Duke Media Foundation, where you can check out all the fine work his organization does. Plus, as Bill mentioned, don't forget to check him out on the TV series Black Lightning on the CW. Check your local listings. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship. Or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to singer and actress Carolyn Fay. Plus, Stuart Nauman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. That would be greatly appreciated. Well, in North College Hill, Ohio, on November the 6th, Noel Hines' criminal love for Thin Mints finally caught up with her when she was arrested for stealing a large order of Girl Scout cookies last March. North College Hill police said Hines took delivery of the cookies valued at more than $1,600 and intended for a local Girl Scout troop, and never returned or paid for them. When Hines showed up at the town's mayor's court on an unrelated matter, police arrested her, then posted on Facebook, "That's the way the cookie crumbles." Oh, nice Facebook touch by the police there. I'm guessing Noel isn't in line to receive any kind of merit badge. Yeah. In Italy, an unnamed 48-year-old woman was ordered to pay $1,000 in late October after failing to peacefully settle a 2-year dispute with her mother. The daughter, a vegan, threatened her mother with stabbing after the mother prepared bolognese meat sauce. The daughter told the court she had long avoided sensory and olfactory contact with animal products before moving back in with her mother, but there had been an escalation of aggression between the two women, and apparently the long simmering sauce was the last straw. "If you don't stop on your own, I'll make you stop," the March 2016 complaint quoted the daughter as saying as she grabbed a knife. "Quit making ragu or I'll stab you in the stomach." The daughter did move back into her mom's house, right? Yeah. Did the daughter assume that just because she's now a vegan that her mother now has to become one? in her own home? And please tell me that in addition to paying the fine, the daughter now has to find someplace else to live. That would be the right thing to do, if you ask me.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
A Melbourne, Australia teen allegedly executed a series of frauds that would have put the most practiced con artist to shame, all before his 17th birthday. Police say the boy falsely reported a burglary, collected a $27,770 insurance claim that he used for camera gear, a drone, and a down payment for a truck. He's also alleged to have fraudulently rented cars and driven them without a license. There it is again. Faked a multinational corporation and used fraudulent documents to get his new truck fitted with emergency lights, which he then used to respond to crash scenes where other emergency workers didn't realize he was not a legitimate responder. He faces 120 charges, including reckless conduct endangering serious injury, attempting to obtain a financial advantage, making a false report, dealing with the proceeds of crime, theft, and unlicensed driving. He is going to do well at whatever he does, the magistrate says. He's a highly productive young man. I have no doubt he will be a success. We don't want it to be criminal. You know, if he doesn't join the police, he might just beat them. I'm just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, for 37-year-old Jackie Fulmer of Fairmont, West Virginia, October 9th started with trying to steal keys from a woman at knife point. When police caught up to her, she ran toward their car with a hatchet and knife, prompting a deputy to shoot her with a stun gun. Fulmer turned to verbal attacks while being transported to the Fairmont Police Department, warning officers she was going to stab them in the neck and watch their blood drain as she drank it, which, as it turns out, she could have done because she had a knife hidden between her buttocks. That weapon was found during booking, and Fulmer admitted she had slashed the seatbelt in the police cruiser with it before threatening to slit the officers' throats. She was charged with threats of terrorist acts and attempted robbery. Well, gentlemen, this is a lady you might want to swipe left on. And she has a few anger management issues, to say the least. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Singer and actress Carolyn Fay is back on the program. She's here to talk about the release of her fourth album entitled Sugat Ko. Her first official video from the album is Jerusalem Thorns. Before we get to Carolyn, here's a little taste of Jerusalem Thorns.
Sun's come up and I'm beaten down. Got miles to go, my feet's been burning. My love's gone lost, my spirit's worn. Oh, Lord, I feel Jerusalem's thorns. Winds bringing heat, I cry myself. I see no end to carry my burden. I'm a beaten soul with no recourse. Oh Lord, I feel Jerusalem's thorns. There's 15 miles to climb that mountain. Got blisters in my soul, but I keep on walking. My mind's in hell and my hands are bleeding. There ain't no way for my salvation, oh Lord. I feel Jerusalem's thorns, oh Lord. I feel Jerusalem's thorns, oh Lord. I feel Jerusalem's thorns, oh Lord. I feel Jerusalem's thorns.
Caroline joins us on the line via Skype from here in Montreal. Hi, Caroline.
Hi. Thanks for playing the tune.
People have to see the video, but it is one of the most riveting, haunting songs I've heard, especially when you add it to the visual. It has a way of, it's almost like a combination of Native American and gospel.
Oh, Peter, you got it. Thank you. Thank you. And the haunting part of it, too. Thank you so much for nailing that.
How did that come to be? What's the background?
The process of the song, once upon a time, I was having a really nasty day. Nothing was going right in my personal, in my business. Excuse me. Nothing was going right. So I come home, I sit at my computer, and I just write this song. I couldn't type fast enough. It was like one of those days where every corner you turn, something goes wrong. Every time you try to fix it, it just didn't work. So I couldn't type fast enough to write the song. And then I called my musicians. Must have been something like 7 or 8 at night. So most of them were gigging except for my drummer. So I said, you know, Brandon, you and me in the studio right now, I need to get this out of my system. He didn't know what was happening. You know, Brandon, the drummer, usually in a recording, they're the first ones to get recorded and then all the other instruments come in. So he figures, okay, that's how we're going to do it. We're in the studio. I sing him the song, and I said, I want, right now I am angry, I'm desperate, I need to get out of this hole, I need that vibe. I need that vibe of marching, getting something done. And out comes his drumming, and I said, okay, done. And he says, what do you mean, done? I said, this is it. I don't want guitars, I don't want keyboards, I don't want bass, it's just you and me. So it took us we had it done almost in the equivalent of one day. The song was done. Just a matter of tweaking it until we finally got into the studio to record the final take.
Wow.
It was inspiring. You know, when bad stuff happens, I was just inspired to get it out of my system, and there it is.
Now, this comes from your fourth album, which is called Sugat Ko?
Yes, it is.
What does that mean?
Sugat Ko in Tagalog, Philippine national language, means my wound.
Ah, okay.
So that's why you got it. I mean, you really nailed it because, you know, you don't know what the title of the album means, and then Jerusalem's thorns come in, and there it is. It's haunting, it's painful, it's eerie, and then the gospel of hope. I need to get out of this.
It's very, very impressive. Now, there's been a while between album 3 and 4. Why so long?
Ah, yes. Album 3 was when I lost someone very close to me who happened to be my music agent. That was album 3, 4 or 5 years ago. So because he was also a good friend of mine, It took me a long time to get over his death. The gentleman was only 49 years old. And then that incident just started a domino effect of band members changing visions until it was clear to me, like, okay, this is not the stage husbands I need to be with now. So there was a divorce. And then in between, I was looking for musicians, trying out playing with other good musicians, but the click wasn't there until not too long ago. I think it would be 3 years. That's when I started finding people, finding the new stage husbands and wives sometimes. Stage husbands and stage wives, depending on the gig. And here we are, 4 years later. And I promise the next one won't take 4 years.
Okay. Now, I think you almost answered this question right off the bat. But now that this is out and the video that goes with it again, together,
oh, yes.
it's all great. But the end product for you, is it very cathartic?
Oh, cathartic, yes. Totally cathartic. Even the video, just the video, I connected with this newly graduated film student at the time, and I gave him the album and I said, listen to this. I want you to listen to the whole album and choose one song. And then from that one song, I want you to pitch an idea to me. He chose Jerusalem's Thorns. And then he pitched it, for those of you who will eventually see the video, you will see three Asian women or Native women, depending on how the audience absorbs the video. But the story on that is all those three women is that one older woman represented in different stages of her life.
Mm.
So it's funny because now that the video has been launched, I look back at it. There is a legend in the Philippines. These women, actually, it's a half-truth. They are called the Babaylans. They are like women warriors, witches, shamans. And there's a culture in the Philippines where it's a matriarchal society where they take the lead. And it's funny now that I've taken 10 steps back and I'm looking at the video, this is all about it. This is all about these Babaylans. And I need to tip a hat to Simon Gianet and François Erkel of Literal Films. They are now an official video company, and it is their vision that extends this haunting song, Jerusalem's Thorns.
Now, people here in Montreal know you primarily and not only as a great jazz singer, but an actress as well. You certainly do combine those two in the video. But again, when one thinks of jazz, one thinks of a certain type of music, certain style. This one is infused with your heritage, Philippine
yes.
heritage. Is that something you haven't done a lot of before?
I have not done at all before. it took me over half a century to accept who I am. I mean, jazz, blues, it's a North American culture that, because I came to Canada at a young age, I basically was a lost soul in this all cultural warfare. I completely forgot my Filipino-ness. So now, with all the catharsis that happened within the past 4 or 5 years, I thought, this is time. There's no other ground I can step on except on my own feet. We'll walk on whatever ground I'm on. So it's just me accepting my Filipino-ness now, and this is what came out, something completely true, honest. I was scared when I launched the video and the songs. I didn't even have an official launch party, which I usually do. That's how scared I was.
Well, you've come up with something that is certainly fresh. I'll say that, because it's a great twist, and I love it. I gotta say it, I love it. And people have got to see this video that accompanies this particular song, and also check out the album. Carolyn, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you.
Singer and actress Carolyn Fay. Her new album is Sugat Ko. Check out the song and the video. It's very haunting and it's great stuff. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the What's On page for this program, which is show number 0483. And you'll find links to Carolyn's site, plus links to the video that you can watch for your own listening and viewing pleasure. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As Americans celebrate Thanksgiving this week, children in schools across the nation are learning about how the first pilgrims relied on Native Americans to survive their first year. The members of tribes indigenous to this land taught the new settlers many things, including how to grow food and identify toxic plants. Today, there's still a lot we can learn from Native American tribes. Did you know that there are about 150 tribal courts across the United States? Unlike state and federal courts that use an adversarial system to resolve disputes, many tribal courts use a different approach. Legal experts describe it as a holistic philosophy that focuses not just on punishment and providing victims with payment, but on bringing harmony and peace to the community. Let's be fair. In recent years, U.S. courts have actually adopted some of this philosophy by promoting alternatives to litigation, like mediation and arbitration. This Thanksgiving, learn how alternative dispute resolution often leaves people thankful they ditched their lawsuit and tried something new. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And as some try to drain the swamp, others simply write about it. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Peter. You're not implying that I write about the swamp. I think I know what you're talking about here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book by, how can I say, if there's a god for journalists out there, it's going to be Bob Woodward. You know, because, you know, since the beginning of this year, which marked the first anniversary of Donald Trump being sworn in as the 45th president of the United States, there has been a whole tidal wave of books that has examined practically every aspect of his controversial presidency, whether they were written by insiders, outsiders, experts, journalists, or pundits. They looked at Trump as president, what goes on inside his White House, or his alleged Russian connection. You can fill an entire case of bookstore shelves with books about President Trump, favorable or unfavorable. Now consider this. Michael Wolff's runaway bestseller Fire and Fury, which was released earlier this year, that was the spark that lit the fuse. And Bob Woodward's latest inside presidential tome, Fear, is the explosion.
Yes.
It certainly is. So, and Woodward, using his Pulitzer Prize-winning skills as an investigative reporter and best-selling author, by conducting hundreds of hours of interviews and doing diligent research through plenty of official and secret documentation, gives a chilling, frustrating portrait of how this apathetic train wreck is running things from his perch at the Resolute Desk in the Oval Office. So, like when he was a presidential candidate, Trump admitted that fear was real power, but when you read Woodward's book, the real fear that arises is how less than 2 years in office, he has ran the presidency with a complete disregard for the office and a complete disrespect for the traditions and procedures that have been developed for over 200 years in order to realize the chief executive's legislative agenda. And there are many glaring examples that Woodward offers in this book, many behind-the-scenes looks at how Trump is president in his own unique improvisational way, and I don't mean that in a good way, Peter. A couple of examples, there's former high-level staffers Reince Priebus, Gary Cohn, and Rob Porter, who represented rare examples of rationality and procedure in the Oval Office by preparing thorough briefs and reports on a number of salient issues that merited Trump's attention, only to have them totally ignored or paid lip service at best by the president. Then there's Trump's rather unorthodox presidential work ethic, in which he didn't arrive at the Oval Office until 11 a.m. and was prescribed quote-unquote executive time to help him fulfill his daily presidential duties, which comprised mainly of watching several cable news broadcasts and making constant phone calls to friends and allies. And the list just goes on as he rather dodges his way through a number of issues and matters during those 18 months. You know, with subsequent books on presidential that Woodward has written on presidential administrations from Reagan through Obama, you know, Woodward has become the authoritative, objective voice into what really goes on within the quarters of power in the White House and the characteristics of the president of the United States and his main power players who made their respective administrations tick. So, and you know what? And the thing is, Peter, the story of the Trump presidency is not over yet, with continuing issues like, you know, like what happened since the book was published, like the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the migration caravan, his move to abolish birthright citizenship, and yes, those turbulent midterm elections. I have a feeling Woodward will be busy once again telling the inside story of life in the Trump White House, whether through an expanded paperback edition next year or a totally new separate volume called maybe More Fear.
Well, you know, it might be a situation where, and Bob Woodward is the best at telling such a story, but isn't there going to be at some point fatigue from people who no longer want to hear it because it just seems to be going on like the death scene from Camille?
It's very possible. You know, you're right. But the thing is that, you know, somehow every day there's something new happening that's always, you know, putting Trump not in a favorable light. I mean, you know, is there something favorable, some legislation or some vital legislation that gets passed or whatever? But no, it's always something that's, you know, totally off kilter.
Well,
and it just doesn't end.
Well, call me when it's all done and they finally do Trump the Musical. That'll be it.
Well, if they can do an opera about Nixon in China, just say, yeah, maybe Trump the Musical can hit Broadway one day.
Yeah. Anyway, the book is called
Fear, Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $39.99.
I always ask you, what other books do you recommend in this genre? But I'm afraid to ask that question for fear the floodgates will now open.
Well, let's open up just a tiny crack.
It's like opening up Fibber McGee's closet.
Do you expect the whole closet to just fall out with bangs and clutters and all that?
Nothing but Trump books. Nothing but Trump books.
Well, no, I don't have. I have a couple of. I have a Trump book, but you're gonna like this one, and a couple of Bob Woodward books, non-presidential.
Okay.
First, the Bob Woodward books. The ones I recommend, and there's a whole canon of them. But two I recommend. One is called The Secret Man, which he co-authored with Carl Bernstein about Mark Felt, the man who was Deep Throat.
Right.
So that's a good book. It's a nice little book. It was published in 2005. And also Veil, about the secret wars of the CIA during the Reagan administration, which was published in 1987 in the wake of the Iran-Contra hearings.
Is that the Charlie Wilson story?
No, not Charlie Wilson. It was more Bill Casey.
Bill Casey, okay.
Yeah, Bill Casey.
Yeah.
And speaking of Trump, Stephen Colbert, God bless him, him and his crew put together a quickie kids book called Whose Vote Is This Vote? Comments That Don't Help in the Aftermath of a Hurricane. And these are quotes that Trump said when he visited the Carolinas in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. And it almost sounds like a Dr. Seuss kind of book, but Dr. Seuss is much more intelligent. But this is pretty funny, ironically funny, actually. And it's also published by Simon & Schuster. It's $19.99. And proceeds from this book will go to several hurricane relief organizations for the victims of Hurricane Florence.
Okay, so again, this week's book is?
Called Fear, Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $39.99.
And when people are looking for you, other than the fact that you're often leading large caravans heading toward the border, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me in the pages of Montreal Times, in which that's one press pass that Trump won't revoke. You can in print every week, every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. Now, if you don't mind, I have to go tweet somewhere, something.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way, to listen to radio. Well, a former boxer has choked to death during a televised croissant eating contest in Argentina. The death of 56-year-old Mario Mello was announced by his sister. Ada Mello told the local TN television channel that was watching as her brother collapsed behind the contest announcer as he was choking on a media luna, a traditional Argentine croissant. She said that people thought he was pulling a prank, but he kept desperately gesturing to the announcer for help. She said a doctor finally was summoned from the audience, and Mello was rushed to a local hospital in the town of Pinamar, where he was later declared dead. Mello was a light heavyweight and heavyweight champion from South America in the 80s and 90s. Successful in the ring, but done in by a croissant. The Darwin File, because the tree of life is often self-pruning. Well, everyone's been there. It's Saturday night. You've had three mojitos too many. And the next thing you know, you're running down the street with a live crustacean in your hand. A Florida woman found herself in hot water after Pinellas County deputies say she stole a live lobster from its tank while being kicked out of a restaurant. It happened at a Red Lobster in St. Petersburg. According to a sheriff's office report, 42-year-old Kimberly Gable was being loud and causing a scene while at a restaurant on November the 10th. The manager of the establishment asked her to leave the restaurant because she was disturbing other customers. The report goes on to say Gable was loud and cursed out the manager. She then grabbed a live lobster out of the tank by the front door before exiting. Deputies were called to the scene and found Gable a short distance away, where they say she smelled of alcohol. The report states, when asked, Gable didn't know what she did with the lobster because she was, quote, blacked out drunk and she did not care because she did not do anything wrong. Gable is charged with petty theft. No word on what happened to the lobster. Well, clearly, this was a shellfish act. Yeah. When a 9-year-old student brought $2,100 of his parents' money to Connerton Elementary School in Land O'Lakes, Florida, his teachers intervened. They counted out the money and put it in the principal's office. The boy's mother picked up the cash a few days later, but realized on the way back to her car that she only had $1,200. The son's teacher verified the $2,100 total, so she called the Pasco County Sheriff's Office. 50-year-old principal Edward Abernathy told deputies that he had counted the money and verified the amount, then hid it inside a speaker on a shelf. According to the sheriff's office, the rest of Abernathy's story changed several times, including saying that the student could have taken the $900. When the deputy pointed out that it would be hard for a child to reach a 6-foot-high shelf, Abernathy agreed it would be a bit of a reach. He was arrested on a charge of grand theft and released on $2,000 bail. What, they couldn't make it $2,100 bail just for the symmetry of the whole thing? Wow, a principal without principles. What are the odds of that? Yes. In any case, boys and girls, it's time now for the moment you've all been waiting for. Yes, it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
Burning random items in a backyard pool, including a hot tub, didn't work out well for a Mayorstown, Pennsylvania man who is now facing a citation for illegal burning. 38-year-old Jonathan M. Gaiman was cited after police went to his house at around 12:06 p.m. on October the 9th and found Jonathan burned a hot tub in an in-ground pool behind a home, according to South Lebanon Township Police. Other items were being burned as well. Police were notified because the fire got out of control due to the foam insulation in the hot tub, which caused the siding on the back of the residence to melt. The citation was for violating a South Lebanon Township burning ordinance. Now, why, oh why, would you be setting fire to a hot tub inside a swimming pool And why would you not think that said fire couldn't get out of control? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0483. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0483. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.